comments to all of our brethren about it. It was one of those unexpected signs which I read about in the catalog, and I obtained it from Northern Ireland. It was published in 1632 by Theophilus Bobburn. Theophilus Bobburn was the man who introduced the Sabbath day on a very broad public basis in England in the early part of the 17th century. And if you know something of the history of the Church of God, Sabbatarians, Seventh-day Baptists, or other terms that were used to define members of the church and others, you will know that Mr. Bobburn was instrumental in publicizing the knowledge of the Sabbath and is an important figure in the history of the Church of God during this period. Unfortunately, he departed from the faith. It is my understanding that others did not, but he was one who did. The book is entitled A Defense of That Most Ancient and Sacred Ordinance of God, the Sabbath Day. I talked to Miss, this is the second edition, corrected and amended with a supply of many things formerly omitted. It is addressed inside to the King's Most Excellent Majesty, Charles, by the grace of God, King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, defender of the Christian faith, etc. Most dread and renowned sovereign, may it please your excellent majesty that in the power of truth, and especially in religion, that they which have once tasted it cleave unto it more than unto all the hopes of this life besides. Then he quotes, "The law of thy mouth, saith David, is better unto me than thousands of gold and silver," Psalm 119, verse 172. "Yea, such is the excellency of God's blessed truth, as his meekest servants will stir in the defense of it in the mildest fight before it shall be endamaged by their forbearance. I durst not petition your highness, nor adventure into these lines, into your majesty's consideration, until I had by diligent study first so settled my conscience in the certain truth of them, as my mind gave me, that I am tied in conscience rather to depart with my life than with this truth. So captivated is my conscience and enthralled to the law of my God. Here, therefore, I tender this truth," spelled T-R-U-E-T-H, "with my life unto your majesty, that unto your godly consideration this, unto your clemency and mercy, and both to the pleasure of the Almighty." Now, in reality, this man, of course, denied what he said. It was very unfortunate. He said he put his life on the line. And when the king called him to account, he recanted. My memory may be inadequate at this point, which is not the main theme, but I believe it was his wife who remained in prison to the end of her life for the Sabbath day. And this, of course, under a great many trials, but it is an illustration to what extent that those who make public boasts may often have to give a public account. Anyway, I should like to bring this to your attention. Mr. Dean Blackwell thought that he would never see a copy, and I meant, in fact, to have it in his hands this weekend, but his brother left the day before I called to have him take it. So it is in our hands this weekend here, and I would like Mr. Hopkinson to have a chance to look at it. He worked very many years closely with me in the academic and other functions. Some of the titles at the top, "The Defense of the Moral Law and Exposition of the Fourth Command," and just skimming through, "The Lord's Day is Not God's Sabbath Day." That's a long one. "God's Ancient Sabbath are not abolished." I have not read the book, and I assume at this moment he is referring only to the seventh day of the week as it recurs. Now, if it has to do with something more than this, I would be very interested, and I have not taken the time to go over it yet. Because somewhere along the line, there isn't any question that the knowledge of the Sabbath day was all that remained, and the knowledge of the annual Sabbath disappeared, which knowledge was available at an earlier time in the Middle Ages on the basis of the records from the Inquisition. The Lord's Sabbaths are still in force. And a dissertation touching practice, that is, how to keep the Sabbath, an exhortation to reformation. This, in other words, represents what we might call the literary production of the history of the Church of God. That is, it's similar in its day, and it's a book, to the literature that we produce in our time. In this sense, I think it should be a very interesting insight into one aspect of the story of the people of God in Britain. And it was from this group of people, of course, that the message was transplanted into the United States in Rhode Island. I will draw to your attention, if you haven't met him, that Mr. Joseph Picasso Jr. is here. I think that's his wife, but I must put on my glasses to smile so I could guess. I was guest at their home when visiting Arizona the previous time, and of course I had a chance one Sabbath while not here to visit Yuma. I hope you all take for granted that I'm not at the beach when I'm not here on the Sabbath. I'm either in the sands of Yuma or the sands of Phoenix. I would extend the very best wishes of our brethren in Milwaukee, where Mr. and Mrs. Grady, G-R-E-D-E, he commonly calls himself Grady for the Anglo-Saxon world, where Mr. and Mrs. Grady had invited us, their daughter not uncommonly at 10 here, I think. Is she here today somewhere? No, she's not. She works with the Patton, the extended Patton family. Would you please extend to her, my wife, and my best wishes? They invited three of us. I mentioned that all our children were above 12, and of course, therefore, you have to pay more. So they thoughtfully at least included one, and we suggested that what might be best is Carlina, since she is older and has had some college experience. That it would be nice to have her get acquainted so that if their children do come out to the campus here, they'll know someone already who can give pointers regarding the educational program and experience of social life on the campus. The state of the church is fine. Mr. Carl McNair is basically responsible, and a number of other assistants. They've had a drought. It possibly has been broken as far as the present crop is concerned. And I think that is very important. It seems that the weather is unusual in that just before one writes off the crop, the rain comes almost at the last minute. The same thing happened in part of the region of Kansas, western Oklahoma, and the Texas Panhandle, where many, in fact, were ready to plow up their withered corn and plant maize. In many instances, the rain came within the last few hours or days before the decision had to be made. And my wife's father has written that a number have made good crops. And this is I think it ought to be taken as a warning, because sometime it's going to go the other way and it will be all over. And I think we live, even as our water shortage in this state, we live with the idea that we can get by because it's bound not to get that much worse. And then we take for granted that it won't be that serious. Today I would like to cover a topic that for some might have been better at first, but I think should have been third in order on prophecy. I think it's an area in which we need to understand certain fundamentals and how we came to understand what we do. for most who have left have also lost understanding. And the first time I analyzed the subject of prophecy for you, I went through the Bible to show you what is fundamental. And it does seem that there is a far greater tendency to want to understand the obscure, the mysterious, than to grasp that which is fundamental and paramount. What is, of course, fundamental is the nature of the Bible as a book revealing God's plan in advance, which is of the nature of prophecy and an insight into the books that are called prophets. And we discovered there, of course, that what is fundamental to the biblical account is not what man does, but what God proposes to do and will do. And consequently also, what will befall human beings who depart from the law of God and are not in conformity with the government of God, which is prophesied to be reestablished, the government and the kingdom of God. Then we took a look at the world events today and saw something of the world in which we live and the trends in the last 30 or so years from the Second World War till now, and where we have swung around from a crisis in Asia to a crisis in Africa, which will precede an ultimate crisis at the buildup in the Middle East. And there is no doubt that events are focusing there. What I would like to do today is take you through a number of chapters of the Bible. We're not trying to analyze these chapters in terms of explaining to new people, although some few of you may be new, verse by verse. Rather, I want to take you through a number of chapters, especially Daniel 2, 7, and maybe sections of 8. Perhaps of one or two other passages in Daniel, Revelation 13, Revelation 17. Now, necessarily, we could make a whole topic out of each one if we were going to prove what conclusions we may draw from each of these primary chapters. What I want to do today is to give us an understanding of how the church came to grasp, in contradistinction to the understanding of the Seventh-day Adventist, or to the Church of God Seventh-day in certain points, or to many other groups. There are certain distinctions pertaining to these chapters. Let's say contrast that also to the Jehovah's Witnesses. How did the Church of God, the worldwide Church of God, come to draw certain distinctive conclusions? I think we should have it in mind, because if those things are kept in mind, we will not be in the situation of some are who have completely lost all understanding of the last 2,000 years of human experience, who once understood. First of all, I drew attention, when going through the first of the three sermons, that the book of Daniel is not listed among the prophets. That came, or should have come, as a surprise, because as the Hebrew Old Testament has been given to us, we start the prophets with Joshua, and we proceed through a combination of Joshua, Judges as one book, and the four books of Samuel and Kings, of putting them in the scroll form. We divide them up in the printed book form. And then the three primary prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then the 12 minor ones. So the last of the prophets is Malachi, and the first is Joshua. And when you read those books, you have an entirely different perspective of the emphasis of prophecy than when you read Daniel. Now, the third division of the Old Testament is called the Writings. Now, in the Writings are works by prophets. But the significance is that these are separate books that that includes various works, prophetic psalms, maybe philosophy, as in Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. But then, interestingly, there is a book completely different from others in the Old Testament, which is a message that was delivered in a Gentile country, in the kingdom of Babylon, and to some small extent in the kingdom of Media Persia, after the fall of Babylon. That's the book of Daniel. The primary purpose of some of the chapters in the book of Daniel would be to reveal to the Gentiles what their leaders needed to know, what would befall their government. And then there is a backup of information after chapter 4 that fills in other prophecies given to Daniel that were not altogether necessary for the Gentiles, but specifically were important in terms of the house of Judah, in which Christ was to be born. What I want to do is take a look at some of the fundamentals. I've already mentioned the chapters in the book of Daniel and Revelation. Revelation is the New Testament counterpart in much of its form to the book of Daniel. If we turn to the Bible now, what we will do for the moment is glance at chapter 2. Now, we're not going to go through it verse by verse. I am presuming, and for purposes here of a congregation that has had many years of continuous history, I will only give certain aspects of a background, and then we will focus in on important things that distinguish what the church understands. First of all, in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of which you have heard many times. In this dream is an image in the form of a human being with head and shoulders and arms, the legs and the feet and toes. What we learn from this is without a question that is fundamental to the whole history of Gentile government. It is the end product and the thinking of man cut off from God. In other words, it is not an image of God, it is an image of man. And we're talking about human government. We're not talking about the government of God. There are a number of denominations or groups or cults who have studied Daniel and Revelation. The primary works have always been those of Sabbath keepers in the last century and the present one. Sometimes they are the works of those who have understood other things, such as the Jehovah's Witnesses and related groups that have been associated with that general body of people. Now, the basic understanding that Mr. Armstrong came to in this chapter when he read it many years ago is typical of the understanding that we find among Sabbath keepers. And that is that it is the story of human government, the Babylonian system, beginning with ancient Babylon on the Euphrates, its successor empire, which made its capital at the Euphrates, though had other capitals in Persia, that is the Medo-Persian Empire, and then the Grecian realm, which made its capital, you know, and Alexander was going to make Babylon, not Macedonia or Athens, the capital of the world empire, and then its divisions, one of which of course, occupied the region of Babylon, but if you read the story later in Daniel, you will discover that Alexander's Grecian Empire split up and came to be known as a kingdom in the north and a kingdom in the south, centering one on the East Mediterranean and the Tigris-Euphrates, and the other centering on the Nile. And then there comes a fourth realm, and Sabbath keepers as a whole have seen it to be Rome, because Rome ultimately occupied and swallowed up the whole of the north and south apart from Ethiopia. Now, I just summarized that. When Mr. Armstrong first studied it, he drew some conclusions he does not now draw. And I think it is important, and so many would have had better understanding if we had, in fact, understood that Mr. Armstrong grew in his understanding of some of these prophecies as the church should grow. And there were those, I think, who left who assumed that Mr. Armstrong understood everything completely and without alteration from a beginning point. And therefore, when there was understanding of the Hebrew not apparent in the English on Pentecost, when there was understanding on marriage, some of them, shall we say, blew it instead of growing. When Mr. Armstrong first looked at this chapter, he noted the following. You will take a quick look. There's the discussion of the image's head, the breast and arms, verse 33, the legs and the feet. And you saw, so that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote it. And this stone, of course, reflects the government of God. If Armstrong saw the head as Babylon, the breast and arms as silver as Medo-Persia, the legs of iron was the Roman world, the brass, of course, was the Grecian, and the feet part of iron and clay, he did not see clearly. When he first described it, and I think it's important that we understand that there is sometimes this growth, he pictured the toes. Notice verse 42, the toes of the feet were part of iron, part of clay. He thought of the 10 toes as successive revivals of the Roman Empire. And in the earliest 50s, or I think it was something like that, when it was revised for a plain truth article, Mr. Armstrong corrected it and came to understand that the feet and the 10 toes represent two separate things. That the feet represented the revivals of the Roman world, and I am not saying he interpreted it by looking in chapter 2, I'm merely saying he drew this conclusion, and I'll explain why he did. And he saw the 10 toes as the final 10 components. So, what we draw upon from his experience is that he did not see clearly initially the meaning of the feet and the toes, but a correction was made. This was made now nearly 25 years ago and more. Now let us take a look at this chapter a bit more clearly. Thou, O king, saw a great image, verse 31. This is the interpretation, verse 36. You, O king, are a king of kings. That is the introduction. It is a little flattering, of course, to Nebuchadnezzar to realize what God had given him. You are this head of gold, verse 38. That's the last part of it. Therefore, what we are dealing with is not a history of experience that goes back to Egypt, that goes back to Assyria, and then Babylon, as Jehovah's Witnesses say. We are dealing with a history in which God had dealt up to this time with a history of Israel and Judah. And now he deals with Babylon. That is the first time God has publicly dealt with the Gentile nation as the nation dominating over the children of Israel since the establishment of the nation. You see, chronology was preserved in the history of Israel and Judah. God dealt with them, and then finally, when he sent Judah into captivity, the whole reckoning of time is based on the years of the kings of Babylon, Persia, and Greece, and Rome. In the New Testament, the birth of Christ is dated not on the basis of anything else but the Roman year. We deal with the year of Emperor Augustus. We deal with the year of Emperor Tiberius. This is the pattern. In Daniel, we deal with Nebuchadnezzar and with Persia. In Ezra and Nehemiah, we deal with Persia. No nations before are ever dealt with in the same manner. What is then significant is that Mr. Armstrong could perceive from this, as most scholars have, what is represented by the gold and the silver and the brass. And it did seem clear from reading it that the two legs that were of iron represented ultimately the Roman world in its division as an empire between East and West. Most scholars at this point have no way of understanding the feet and toes from the chapter itself, except as you read. For as you saw all of these things mixed together, the feet and toes, the iron and the clay, verse 43, there would come a time that in the days of these kings, the God of heaven would set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Verse 44, that's the interpretation. And the picture that he's interpreting is earlier. You saw a stone, verse 34, that was cut out without hands, not something of human origin. And it smote the image on its feet that were of iron and clay and broke them to pieces. So it struck the feet, the stone. Now, in actuality, what part of the feet is most likely struck, what we would call the base, the whole thing. And so there is no specific statement about striking, you know, just the toes. It struck that part of the image. That's a general statement. And what we want to know is what the feet and toes represent. The answer is that they are not clearly given. I mean, the answer is it's not clearly given in chapter 2. Now, Mr. Armstrong drew his conclusion on the basis of his study of chapter 7 and related chapters in Revelation. We will now turn to chapter 7 in the book of Daniel. Now, at first, when these were read by Mr. Armstrong, they were very difficult to understand because although Daniel might be reasonably clear, it was Revelation that was difficult. And he had to put them down on paper to get it organized. In chapter 7, Daniel had a dream. And here, instead of seeing human government reflected, he sees the attitude of those human beings in Gentile government. And the attitude is that of wild animals. The four great beasts that Daniel saw differed from one another. And of course, what we shall see is that human nations differ in their attitude and philosophy. And the last was different from all of them. The one was like a lion. The other was like a bear. Another was like a leopard. And then there was the fourth one that was dreadful and terrible and had great iron teeth. Now, as a stop for the moment, we'll have added facts here that help discern. We will not go through all these verses to understand how we discern these because this is now, as a teaching of the church, a reference to past history. Then you can read the literature and who is the beast if you wish to cover it. What is important for the moment is that we focus on what follows. This fourth beast had iron teeth. Now that reflects the iron, you see, in the legs of the image. devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. It was diverse, I'm reading from the King James, from all other beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, at first, Mr. Herbert Armstrong thought it was logical that these 10 horns would correspond to the 10 toes. He came to the conclusion later that that was not the intended meaning, because it actually overlooked the feet. And that the toes were not the same as the 10 horns of this beast. But at first, he did not see the difference. I want you to know that, because I think it is important that we understand that the church has grown, and the more we understand it, the more we understand God's government and his revealing as one studies the Bible. But I might have drawn, and you might have drawn, the same conclusion, because there was an image with 10 feet, and here was a beast with 10 toes. But the story isn't all in. I considered the horn. Now, when this animal came up, he saw the whole political system complete. 10 horns. All there. Now, he considered the horns, and there came up among them another little one that he hadn't seen before. And he plucked up or uprooted a tree. And then he notes that the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment, was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the whiteness of pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire, so that God's throne does move about by some means of transportation in the spiritual realm, and there is the judgment. Now, we do know that we are dealing with a close of human experience. Verse 11 tells us, I beheld because of the voice of the great word which this horn spoke. I beheld till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So the beast's body and the horn, that the whole thing perished in the flame. What we discern then is that the horn that arises is in some way linked up with the political system. It is a characteristic of the system, but it is distinct from all the rest of it, because Daniel's eyes were specifically drawn to this and its peculiar behavior. But it is not something that comes out of Tibet. The rest of the beasts had their dominion taken away, but their lives were prolonged, and of course, many of the nations that have composed the system, other than the last one, have survived for many years. We still have Persia today, we have Greece today, we have Iraq today, we have Egypt and Syria, we have various branches in Western Europe of the old Roman Empire. Well, that's unimportant. We do, anyway, get a general picture. Daniel was troubled, and someone came to him, and we read in verse 16 that Daniel was told that he would have certain things made known. These great beasts which are four are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. Now, on the surface, one might assume there are just four more kings. You know, Daniel might have had that thought pop into his head. The saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess it forever, even forever and ever. And Daniel might think, well, look, this isn't bad, only four more kings and it's all over. But it wasn't quite that way. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from the rest. Exceeding dreadful. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of that other peculiar horn. Happened to be more stout and was more capable of surviving than the others. And I beheld that horn made war with the saints, and then the Ancient of Days came. And he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom. 23. Now, what you may draw from this should be obvious. Daniel had already perceived that there must be some parallel with the first three parts. That is, you have the head of gold, the arms, and the breast area of silver, and the thigh area of brass, and then the rest was iron. And he saw the four major parts, you remember? And he saw iron, and here he sees four beasts, and the last one had iron teeth. So it was rather clear to Daniel that the first three must have their parallels in the first three metals of the image. And Daniel doesn't even have those answered, does he? He only asks questions about the fourth, which is implying that both he and you should be able to understand the previous three. So when it came to the fourth, it says the fourth beast is now a fourth kingdom. At first it was introduced as four kings. Now four kings could be understood quite differently. It might mean only four. But what is in focus here is without a doubt that there are more than one king in any one of these kingdoms, but that one is a paramount figure. That is, there are often dominant ones and then maybe a dynasty of lesser light. Just when we think of Babylon, I would hesitate to ask all of you to write the kings of Babylon from Nebuchadnezzar to its fall in 539 in order, much less to tell them. But you do remember Nebuchadnezzar. You may remember Belshazzar. You might recall Evil-Merodach. But the rest are not even mentioned in the Bible. But Nebuchadnezzar is the leading figure. And the whole government, in a sense, reflects the thinking of Nebuchadnezzar. I cannot say the same thing for the United States, that our government reflects the thinking of George Washington, or we wouldn't be involved in so many problems in the world. But nevertheless, the pattern of government, what was established, would even be true of this country. Without George Washington, we would not have a nation such as ours, because it was through his generalship that the nation was militarily born. In the same way, through Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian government was, in fact, created. Now, this fourth beast is different from all others, and it speaks of 10 kings out of this kingdom. 10 horns, verse 24, are 10 kings which shall arise. Now, at this point, Daniel doesn't know whether the 10 arise all at once or arise in succession. All Daniel knows is that they shall arise. When this was studied in the last century, many brethren who were later to be aware of the Sabbath day, we were in the Adventist movement before the Sabbath by a Seventh-day Baptist was brought to their attention. Many assumed that these would represent 10 divisions in the Roman world. That is, that the Roman world would be divided into 10 parts. Now, we look back and would know it was Rome. In Daniel's day, it would have been extremely difficult. See, Daniel grasped the importance of Persia, because Persia and Babylon were the two dominant ones. He might have had little difficulty in grasping Greece, because without any question, the commercial power was falling into the hands of the Greeks. And without any doubt, the greatness of Greece was already established. But in the middle of the 6th century B.C., Rome was hardly more than a little town in a plain of Latium, 200 years old, and unless God should have revealed it, it would have been extremely difficult to determine that, but Daniel was therefore interested in it, because he couldn't really see on the horizon. As I said before, we don't even know if Daniel had heard of the city of Roma. We don't even know. But from our perspective, there is little difficulty. And in the last century, however, there was a problem in studying it. Were the ten horns all contemporary? Were they, however, successive? All Daniel sees is the beast with the horns. He doesn't see the beast and then suddenly ten horns and then one. He sees the beast with its horns, without one separate one. So as far as Daniel is concerned, all he does is see the whole panorama without any time frame. I'm trying to make it plain so you understand what questions we might have asked, Mr. Armstrong certainly had to ask of himself, and Daniel had to ask. The simple questions, you know, who, how, when, where, why, and they're not all explained. God did not choose to reveal everything as clearly as he might have to Daniel. Now, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first and subdue three. Now, this led many Sabbath keepers in the last 120 years or so to draw the conclusion that there was a power, in this case understood to be a religious power, which would arise after, in time sequence, ten that had already existed. And so, since the assumption here was that they were dealing with a religious power that dominated through the Middle Ages, they drew the conclusion that the ten kings were the ten divisions in the Roman Empire after Rome collapsed. I must say that I have never been able to demonstrate that there ever were consistently ten powers. That at one time there might have been ten, that at another there might have been less, and that at another there might have been more, is demonstrated by an analysis of any map of the old Roman world. And I therefore draw the conclusion that those people who read it put an emphasis on the single word after, as if it had time meaning exclusively. Now, what Daniel is describing is here what he sees. And he sees a beast with ten horns, and then another rises after that as he looks at it. In other words, this occurred later, and he's describing it in terms of his own vision. But is he describing it in terms of the events of history is the question. If it is, then the ten horns were a part of the beast and not something that followed its demise. Because the horns and the beast were all there at once. And even those Seventh-day Adventists and others who've read it have been confronted with the fact that they've had to make the ten horns after the beast when the ten horns were already on the beast and didn't rise after he saw the beast without the horns. Am I making that plain? So that, in fact, the issue is that the word after has been overemphasized and needs to be considered carefully before drawing a final conclusion. It is after only in the sense that Daniel sees it in his vision. That is clear. But is it historically after? Or should it be understood in another light? And that is meaning that it shows similarity. There were three kings uprooted. So we could take another look at this. You know, it is very often true that in prophecy something interesting happens. But whereas one might have seen it from one perspective, one can look at it at a later time and see it from another. A number of brethren over the years have drawn our attention to the possibility that we should see in Daniel chapter 7, not merely a historic perspective of revival and a power that uprooted long ago, a religious power that uprooted three kingdoms that restored Rome in the West. It's very possible that we might see, when all is said and done, not only a historic event over many centuries, but a future event, because there may be not only 10 revivals through history, but 10 parts to the last revival. There may not only have been a horn that eradicated 3 of 10 successive revivals, but there may be a final aspect of the horn that uproots 3 out of 10 units in a realm that is yet to be finalized. We have that to see. There are 10 horns and 3 kings are subdued. But we will pose the question in terms of the future a little bit later. What we want to do now is take note that at this point, Daniel sees 10 toes, he sees 10 horns. First, when Mr. Armstrong studied it, his thought of the 10 toes is equivalent to the 10 horns in terms of succession through history. Then he corrected the matter of the 10 toes. It is also possible that we should consider verse 24 in more than one light, more than a historic light, and see within it events in the future, because we have now a common market of 9, and we have Greece and Spain and Portugal knocking at the door. And how many shall there ultimately be, and how many of these kingdoms, democratic Catholic and Protestant, are going to remain in, will be the question. At this point, Denmark is a wholly Protestant country and seems incompatible. England and parts of Northern Ireland connected with England and Holland are, in fact, essentially divided religiously, as well as East Germany, and the others will be either Greek Orthodox or Roman Catholic. So we want to take a look to see whether indeed verse 24 of Daniel may not be dual. We'll now turn briefly to a small part of of Daniel chapter 8, just in passing. Here is a very strong emphasis on 2 animals, a goat and a ram. And they are defined in verse 20 and verse 21. The ram with 2 horns, the kings of Media and Persia. The rough goat, the first king of Greece, verse 21. So in Daniel's day, it was made clear to him. Now Daniel saw out of these events a certain crisis at the close. Now, we don't want to go into this. We don't have time. But he sees a final king rising up who is pictured as a leader. And then when you go through chapter 11, you are confronted again with the number of kings who are to stand up in Persia. And then you come to the king of Greece in verses 3 and 4. And it's division, and there are many events all laid out here in Daniel 11, which certainly Daniel didn't understand when he first was looking at the prophecy of chapter 2. Daniel 11 fills in a great many details which pertain to the kingdom of brass. I draw to your attention that in reading Daniel 11, many commentators have good understanding of it until they get to verse 33. And beginning with verse 33, a cloud descends over their thinking. And the reason, of course, is that those who keep the commandments have a good understanding. And we are told in verse 33 about those who have an understanding. Now, once you don't know that you're supposed to keep the commandments, you don't have an understanding and therefore can't figure out who do. And since the story pertains to those who have understanding, they are looking somewhere else, and they're trying to look in the Jewish community. They're trying to look somewhere else, and they have never seen that the story of the Church of God which keeps the commandments. And they're looking at some other institution that might be called a church. Verse 33, following the Maccabees, is the story of the Church of God, their history. Even to the time of the end, verse 35, when a king will do according to his will. And there will be a struggle, and we have analyzed and made plain that this is the story of the Middle Ages to modern times, and we haven't yet finished Daniel 11. World War II ended in the middle of verse 40. And verse 41, well, not just in the middle, but near the end of verse 40. He shall enter into the countries, and that's where it stops. And he shall overflow and pass over, did not find fulfillment, only in part. They entered into Egypt. They entered into Ethiopia. The armies wanted to move on to the Middle East, but they never were able to subdue those countries, and they did not overflow and pass over. They didn't enter into the holy, glorious land. So verse 41, in a sense, is yet to be repeated in the end of verse 40. And there may be other sections as a prelude that will have a background. I mentioned to you in the second subject on this series that Mr. Hogberg is pointing up such terms as the North and the South are used to describe the common market and the OPEC country. And that's a term that has taken root and certainly will have its parallel here. Now when we go to Revelation chapter 13, we will notice certain things quickly here. There is a beast and only one. You see, John is given a revelation. Daniel was given a revelation. But Daniel was living when the revelations began. He was living in the time of Babylon. And so he sees everything in the future. John is living in the time of the fourth beast. Greece was already subdued by Rome. So a revelation wouldn't have to go back into history and repeat what has already been there. It is rather an evaluation of a system that is to succeed in time. Here is an animal that had seven heads and 10 horns. And upon his horns were 10 crowns. Now, for the first time, we have the number 7. Now, in looking at Daniel, there were 7 horns. After 3 were uprooted because there were 10 in the first place. Mr. Armstrong, therefore, after much thought, drew the conclusion that the 7 heads here represent the remaining 3 horns of Daniel chapter 7 after the first 3 were uprooted. And John is seeing 10 horns as something well into the future. The implication being that the 10 horns are on one of the heads, the last one, the second. We will also draw the conclusion that it might be possible then to consider that these 10 horns were like the 10 toes of Daniel's feet. And the 7 heads were like the last 7 of the 10 horns of Daniel's 7. This was not immediately clear, but it was at least a possibility when Mr. Armstrong first studied it. You see, Daniel only saw horns, and he saw them in terms of the distant, distant future. And he saw power that could uproot trees. Now, from that point of view, we can look back in time from the 20th century and indeed perceive a historic fulfillment. As John looks ahead, then he's concerned only with the seven that follow the uprooting of the tree. Or I'll say, as God chose John, who is looking into the distance. But we want to be sure that this is the case. Now, the interesting thing is that the beast had characteristics of a leopard and of a bear and of a lion. And in the opposite order, the leopard was Greece, the bear was Media Persia, the lion was Babylon. So it would appear that this beast had, in fact, characteristics of what had preceded. It is the same kind of system, but in reality, it is Daniel's fourth beast. Now, when Daniel saw the fourth beast, he didn't see any heads on it. He only saw horns. Remember that. Daniel didn't see any horns. Any heads on the last beast. He only saw horns. And a horn was a symbol of power, of government, a ram's horn. That's right. Now, from this point, Mr. Armstrong perceived that seven heads are either a new introduction or a new way of explaining something that had already been made clear in Daniel. He drew the latter conclusion, that it is a way of stating what had already happened in Daniel. And ten horns then would represent the ten toes. And the feet, apart from the toes, would represent the seven heads of Revelation 13, verse 1, and would include the seven plus three horns of Daniel chapter 7. And as Mr. Armstrong saw the legs, then he saw the feet, and then he saw the toes. In chapter 7 of the book of Daniel, you only see the beast and ten horns, of which three were later uprooted. But here in Revelation, you see not only a beast, but seven heads and ten horns. So what he was trying to understand is that if you go by what is in the Bible, you don't start to interpret Revelation 13 by Revelation 17 because you haven't come to Revelation 17. You start with Daniel 2. You start then next with Daniel 7, and you move to Revelation 13, and you piece it together step by step, always putting a question mark wherever there may be a question in your mind. It's better to have a question than to assume you have an answer when it is not true. At least we note that this one animal seems to have the characteristics of what had preceded, and therefore it would be logical that this creature here represented the fourth beast, that Roman world. Now, that's one way to look at the story. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Now, this would bring up then another question of whether we are seeing this clearly. Now, when we look at this, we might have to reconsider what we have evaluated from Revelation 13, verses 1 and 2. Let's go back then to another alternative, which I haven't mentioned. Remember, it pays to put a question mark. Mr. Armstrong didn't study all this with an immediate answer. Now, when we see Revelation 13, verse 3, then we come to the question of whether we should reconsider this. And the church has always taught something slightly different than what I first mentioned, and I wanted to go through this So you see what possibilities there are and what we may have to discard along the way as we were to study it. Now, in Daniel 4b of chapter 7, you had a leopard, you had a bear, you had a lion, and you had a fourth one, which was not like any animal. On the lion was one head, on the bear was one head, and on the leopard were four, and on the last one was one head. And there are seven altogether in Daniel chapter 7, there are seven heads. So it's more likely at this stage that the seven heads, and as we look at this, that the seven heads of Revelation 13 are the same as Daniel's seven heads in chapter 7. And the ten horns are the same as Daniel's ten horns. Because we learn in verse 3 that one of its heads was wounded to death, and the deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after this beast, because the beast that might have died lived on. And it was given unto this beast to survive and to exercise significant power for 42 months, which we may interpret in more than one possible way, and the most likely is 1,260 years per thought. All right, what we now then draw the conclusion from is that it is more likely when we look at history that the head which was wounded to death in verse 3 is the head that was on Daniel's fourth beast, and not some successive head down in history, because the beast lived, the wound was healed. Now we have then another perspective, and we'll cross off the first possibility. And if you need to realize that Mr. Armstrong went through all this kind of thinking before he was able to perceive the story clearly. These seven heads here are better seen then as the same seven heads in Daniel, because, in fact, this one beast had all the characteristics of the other beasts in Daniel, and together, the four heads of the leopard, you see, show that there were four divisions that were primary in the Greek world. And those divisions then added up with the other three animals made seven. So, at this point, we would discern from Revelation 13 that we are starting out with a summation of Daniel chapter 7. There's a summation of Daniel chapter 7, and we're now given a time element that the beast is going to survive over a period of time, 42 months or over 1,200 years, 1,260 years. John doesn't know when it begins. He doesn't know when it ends in time. It's all into the future. But it apparently happens after the seventh head is wounded, because it seems to follow. And therefore, we may draw the conclusion that the beast lived on in terms of the succeeding ten horns, two of which, Daniel said, were uprooted. So we now draw the conclusion from chapter 13 that we definitely must see these ten horns equivalent to Daniel chapter 7, 10, and the seven heads equivalent. But when we turn to Revelation 17, we're confronted again with an enigma. Here was a beast, and a woman was riding this beast. First time a woman is introduced. There was a strange horn introduced before. Now, this beast had seven heads and ten horns. On the surface, one might immediately assume these are the original seven heads of Daniel 7, the same seven heads of Revelation 13. But no woman ever rode Babylon or Medo-Persia. Or Greek. Young is the symbol of the church. Therefore, we are now for the first time confronted with the possibility that we found didn't seem to pan out for Revelation 13. Is it possible that these seven heads and ten horns are not the same seven heads and ten horns of Revelation 13, but rather that these seven heads are the last seven horns of Daniel, and therefore the last seven horns of Revelation 13. And Mr. Armstrong came to the conclusion in looking through history and the biblical account that yet follows in this chapter that this was the logical deduction. The ten horns after the beast is pictured in Daniel chapter 7 are not ten divisions, because Rome, though sometimes divided into one and another number, has never had consistently ten. There have been more, there have been fewer. Sometimes there might have been ten, but there's no consistency in it. But he noted here that a woman rides seven, not ten, and it is logical, since the horn is a power with a man's eyes, and it involves itself in blasphemy. Well, this horn would seem to have uprooted three and then likely dominated seven horns that followed. In the same way, we draw the conclusion that this woman who sits on seven heads and ten horns of this beast, that these seven heads would represent the remaining horns of Daniel chapter 7 in the last seven of the ten of Revelation 13. Now we look a little further. The beast that you saw was and is not and shall ascend out of an abyss, verse 8, and go into perdition. And this looks like the final revival. And if we have a final revival, if the beast was and is not and shall ascend, then we learn from this verse here in particular, verse 8, that we should see the history of Rome not in divisions like the Seventh-day Adventists do, but in a succession of revivals where the Roman Empire is revived, and this is the last one. Those who dwell on the earth are going to wonder, as I pointed up, because indeed this beast is going to surprise everybody when it occurs. When they behold the beast that was and is not and shall ascend. That's a better translation than the word yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. And the seven heads are seven mountains. Mountains are symbols of government on which the woman sits. Now, symbolically, there is a city situated on seven mountains. But there is also a church that sat on seven governments. And interestingly, the headquarters of the church is within the confines of the city that's on seven hills. Now, for those of you who have a little knowledge of geography, I'll let you interpret it. Now, we're told there are seven kings. Or kingdom. Daniel learned that four kings doesn't mean just four kings only, but four kingdoms, and it may include four dynasties. That's the usage of the term. Now, when Revelation 17 is looked at, he has this strange addition here that five are fallen, and one is, and the other is yet come. Is not yet come. Now, on this basis, without any question, Revelation 17 verse 10 is seen clearly to indicate a succession. Five are fallen, one is, and one hasn't yet come at a certain time sequence. What is important for this is that we don't see all seven at once. And from this we may draw the conclusion that Daniel's 10 horns are in fact successive. In Revelation chapter 13, the 10 horns are successive, and they are represented by the 7 heads. And when John looks on the time and the judgment is about to occur, 5 of the 7 are gone. 1 is, and only 1 is yet to come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. Now, the knowledge of this verse 10 occurred, if you please, during the 1930s and 1940s. Mr. Armstrong then wondered if Mussolini, which he regarded as the 6th, having studied history and the revivals of Rome, he wondered if Hitler was the 7th. And there are men who have left and said, well, Mr. Armstrong's a false prophet because he posed that question whether it was so. And if Hitler could have pulled off the development of the hydrogen bomb as he was pulling off the development of the rocket, let me tell you, we wouldn't have merely had rocket V2s falling in London. We would have had bombs falling on the East Coast. And there never would have been a VE Day and a VJ Day. It would have been a VA Day. But God stopped it. And I can remember listening to the broadcast in 1943 and 1944, 1946. It was about that time, I think the broadcast wasn't even on in 45, where I could reach it. And Armstrong realized that if Hitler did not come up with an immediate solution, that he was to be regarded as, shall I say, a link with Mussolini and not a successor. Even though he rose to power a little later, Mussolini around 1921, Hitler 1933. And they became an axis. And one must understand history in terms of that term, axis. The Rome-Berlin axis. That's what it was called, the axis powers. For those of you who lived through the period of that time, we have more and more who haven't. As it turns out, you know, when I see our children, all of them never heard of broadcasts about the Axis powers. They can only hear it in recordings. That's how time goes by. Now, it wasn't easy to put all this together, but Mr. Armstrong, after trying first one thing and another, realized that Revelation 17 was going to picture the judgment of this great woman. And the judgment of the great woman comes on her as a result of the fact that she finally links up with the last power that shall be. And that power, and this woman, and fallen church, accomplished something that should never have been done, for which they're going to receive the judgment of God. So that Revelation 17 is not talking about 5 Roman emperors who have deceased, one that is, who's Nero, and one who's yet to come. That's the way some people have tried to explain it. And in fact, every evidence is that John received the revelation in the mid-90s A.D. after 9 emperors and more. Well, after 9 major emperors and a lot of them who came on the throne suddenly in the early 69 A.D. period had long since gone. Some have tried to take verse 10 as a proof that John wrote in the days of Nero, when the universal tradition of the Greek church is quite contrary to this. We're not dealing with the emperors of Rome and the fact that the prophecy failed, that one more was to come and it would all end. We're dealing instead with 7 kingdoms over which a church was to rule, and this fallen church had never yet been sitting on one in John's day, so they don't have the least understanding of who this woman is. Or they would know that this is not Roman emperors, as you can read in a lot of modernistic commentary. There are 7 kings, 5 are fallen, 1 is yet to come, implies that the knowledge of the judgment to the church of God and making it known to the world should begin to occur when a beast is in the form of the sixth heaven. And when the seventh comes, it will continue but a little space. Now, this strange beast is, in fact, an eighth, as it says in verse 11. The beast that was and is not is an eighth, and that mystery is peculiar because it says it is of the seven. Now, when we note that this beast is a single creature and is of the seven, the implication is that John and Daniel previously never saw this beast as a beast. They saw it only as part of the seven that had been before. That is, it's part of the seven heads of Daniel 7, and it's part of the beast with the seven heads of Revelation 13. So what now turns out to be a separate beast really is a head, if you please, of Revelation 13, the last head. This beast, then, is of the seven heads. It, in fact, in a sense, is the seventh head after the deadly wound, because it is that head which has only seven horns left, which are now on this beast, seven heads. So you see, Daniel had a beast with 10 horns. Three were uprooted, then he had a beast with 7 horns, didn't he? We're not worried about the single one, which is symbolic of something else. That will pass by for the moment. So that when we go to Revelation 13, we have this whole composite 7th chapter of Daniel repeated. Only in this case, we don't have many beasts. We have one beast on which all the heads are assembled, and 10 horns. And then we come to Revelation 17. Here is a woman riding, and this can only be after those 3 horns of Daniel 7 have been uprooted. So what we perceive is that this is yet another beast. But it is an eighth, not an eighth beast, because there were only 4 beasts, remember, in Daniel. But it is an eighth. Well, what? It's an eighth system. It is of the seven. So let's take a look as we now draw this to a conclusion. There were 7 heads initially in Daniel's prophecy, which represented Babylon to the Roman Empire. And here we have now another beast, which in a sense is therefore of the seven. It's of the seven. That's important. So we know, in a sense, it is of the seven heads, the 12th beast of Daniel, which ended up in Revelation 13, devouring everything that had gone before. It's another beast. It is of the original 7 heads, but it is that 7th head only after 3 horns were uprooted from Daniel chapter 7. It is a beast that represents the times of the revival of the 7 horns of Daniel 7, or the last 7 of the horns of Revelation 13. Now, in this sense, it is pictured as a separate animal altogether. If you originally had 7 heads, and the last one was wounded, you see, and that wound was healed, this beast represents what happened after that healing. It is therefore like an 8th head, as if the 7th head were killed, the Roman Empire were killed. This is an 8th head, but it actually pertains to the 7 heads that were originally revealed. But now he sees it only, you see, as the last phase. That is, the closer you look toward the end of time, the more it is magnified. And we not only see a beast, that is, the revival of the old Roman system when seven horns are left, but we see those original seven horns that were left now as seven heads or seven kings, of which five are fallen. One is when this prophecy came to be clear to the Church of God in this century, and one is yet to come, and there are ten horns now on this last head, which haven't even received power as yet, when the prophecy is revealed. In other words, when the one head that is on this beast exists, the ten kings haven't received their power, so ten are going to come up after the time the knowledge of this prophecy came to be clear to the church. And they shall receive power as kings for a brief period and give their strength to the beast which exists in the final form at the seventh head. Now from this we see the conclusion that the woman is punished by the horn, which burned her with fire. That there is a conflict between truth and faith. And what I suggest you do, and what I want you to do, is not look at this as a quick summary of what we've had before, but a tackling of the problem much as if we started anew and looked at it and examined and threw out some ideas and retained others. You should go over the booklet, Who is the Beast, or an article that covered this, and even use supportive material from Mr. Paul Cole's work in 72 and 73, and analyze and see how the understanding was assembled. That is, you can go through one chapter and then another, and you can draw some ideas, like I did temporarily, that turn out not to be correct when you look a little further. And that's exactly what Mr. Armstrong faced when he went through it. And he came to realize that there were things in Daniel 2, and especially in Revelation 13 and 17, that would not be clear just by themselves. Possibilities that turn out not to be what was intended in the revelations to Daniel and John. From this, we draw the conclusion that we are looking for not an Islamic empire of 10 Arab nations, we are looking for a Roman system. We are looking for a Roman system that revives the Roman Empire, as Justinian did, as the Empire of Charlemagne did, as the German Empire, the Ottos and immediately succeeding dynasts did, as the Habsburgs did, as Napoleon did, as Mussolini did with the aid of Hitler, and usually these men had in Western Europe a twofold division, and it shall happen again. Very likely a kind of twofold division in Europe, and I would assume it is the economically strong as iron and the economically weak as clay. Nations are going to get together, and there are 10 of them. And to what extent we may find a parallel, who knows? There may be a parallel in uprooting certain governments that are presently within a market situation, the common market. But we will look at this. We haven't yet drawn conclusions. We don't know. The Europeans themselves don't know what is going to occur. But we will keep our ears and eyes open. And what is clearly coming is a continuity of the system of thinking that has been in France and Germany and Italy and Austria all these centuries. The thinking of, if you please, the European man who represents this fourth beast. This is not a man of Persia. This is not a man of the Arab world. It's not a man of Greece. This is, in a sense, a Roman man in terms of the thinking of Europe. And if you have to draw that conclusion when you go through the whole. What will astound the world is, as I said before, that it occurs because there's no reason to think now that it should, if you were to look at world events. And that's what will make it all the more serious. The thing, while we have the 4th of July coming up, and the 3rd, it would behoove you to go through the literature and to ask yourself, if you were to read each chapter, would you draw the same conclusion? If, as you go along, you draw different ones, as Mr. Armstrong initially did, then put a question mark by it, and you learn to study and see if indeed the total picture is not what the church has ultimately come to, insofar as we are at this point in time. And I think we won't have some of the theories that, you know, we can allow to lodge in our minds, or some of the ideas that have come from the outside. I think it is time now, at a point where it is commonly said throughout the Church of God that prophecy is steered clear of, because nobody wants to get his fingers burned. Let me tell you, we'd get our fingers burned if there were 10 Arabs over which a church would, 10 Arab nations, Muslim, over which a church, a Christian church, would reign. But I don't expect that, because that's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is the continuity of existence, which is centered in Europe. Because Europe, the North, is in conflict now economically with the Arab world, the South. And the woman has always ridden the political structure of the North and not the South. And I think that picture is fundamental in terms of what men are doing. And it is time we got back to an understanding so that no ideas coming along will overthrow us. And at the same time, we keep open our minds to see how it is going to be worked out and whether any prophecies may even have a duality that we now don't even perceive. So I alluded to a possibility that some of the brethren have brought to my attention over the years from Daniel chapter 7. Of certain Protestant faiths within a common market framework. I think we should take note of that. Are some going to be put out? Out of 10, are 3 going to be removed, and are other 3 going to replace them so that you may have out of 10, 3 uprooted, and in the end, 10 in all? You know, these are questions of which the church is looking and watching and hasn't spoken definitively yet. But I think we should look, because President Carter admits that this year will be a turning point in terms of the Middle East, where the crisis will ultimately focus. And if he cannot get the Jews, the Israelis, and the Arabs to each relinquish the unrelinquishable claim, then he said the world has had it.